Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is on a cruise with public radio listeners. China recently overtook the United States as the world's largest producer of greenhouse gases. Like the U.S., China relies on energy produced from burning coal. Both countries have strong incentives for finding ways to reduce coal plant emissions, but the technical challenges are formidable. So are the politics. Joining me in the studio to talk about U.S.-China collaboration on the issue, Kenneth Lieberthal, director of the China Center at the Brookings Institution, and Bruce Stokes, a columnist at National Journal. And from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York, Orville Schell. He's director at the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Well, welcome to you all to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Great to be here,
Susan.
We are going to invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, Orville Schell, tell me how important the issue of coal is when we talk about the question of global climate change.
Well, I think focusing particularly on the United States and China, we are both abundantly endowed with coal reserves. Some 80% of China's electrical power comes from coal. In the United States, it's about 50%. And there's no, I think, prospect anytime soon that either country will abandon coal. And these comprise, as you suggest, these two countries are the largest emitters, about over 40% of the world's annual emissions. So simply put, if the U.S. and China cannot come to terms with coal and CO2 emissions, I think it's very doubtful that the world will soon find any remedy for climate change.
So, Bruce, give us an update on what the United States and China have been talking and trying to iron out before the big UN conference in Copenhagen next month.
Well, the sticking point is really whether the United States can make commitments in Copenhagen to reduce its emissions on a par with the kinds of emission commitments that the European Union and Japan have said they will make. China, on the other hand, is unwilling to make a commitment to cap its emissions, to top off its emissions. They are willing, though, to make a commitment to reduce the growth rate of their emissions, which is an important first step, but unfortunately insufficient in the long run to deal with the problem. So one of the tensions here is we would like the Chinese to do more. They claim that they're doing as much as they can do. They've done a great deal already. And they point to us and say, you haven't passed your Senate legislation yet.
Well, let's talk about that, Ken. This Senate legislation has been stalled. Some efforts this week to revive it. But how much difference does that make when it comes to trying to seek Chinese cooperation on this issue?
Well, the U.S. has a real credibility problem on the issue of global climate change. The global perception is that over the 8 years of the Bush administration, we simply set this issue aside. Even in the Clinton administration, signed on to the Kyoto Protocol but could not get it ratified in the Congress. So the U.S. record here is not very strong. Chinese negotiators have repeatedly come to the U.S. over the course of 2009. They've talked to the top people in the executive branch and get very excited about what they hear. Serious people, serious commitments, real determination. Then they go up to Capitol Hill and at the end of the trip say, you know, we don't think you're going to end up getting this done. And if you aren't going to get it done, why should we take on the burdens that will potentially slow down our economic growth as you slip through on a free ride saying essentially we'd love to do it, but unfortunately our political system doesn't allow us to get there?
So, Orville Schell, how big a problem do you think that is?
Well, I think, you know, Congress is an enormous obstruction at this point. And I think, you know, in talking to Chinese colleagues, I often find myself pointing out that the real contradiction is not simply between the United States and China. In a curious way, it's between the Chinese leadership and the Obama administration, the leadership here, and the U.S. Congress, and that both sides, if they expect to get this problem remedied in any measure, are going to have to think of some sort of a strategy to convince the requisite majority in Congress to pass legislation. Otherwise, the U.S. has no standing, and the U.S. is in a very sort of amputated leadership position. And without the U.S., I don't think the rest of the world can act.
You know, Bruce, we want to go back in a moment to talk more directly about some of the technical issues and involved with regulating coal emissions. But just briefly, we had an announcement on Wednesday from just yesterday from three key senators, Lindsey Graham, a Republican, John Kerry, a Democrat, and Joe Lieberman, an independent, who are going to make an effort to try to craft some kind of new energy bill that might be able to get the 60 votes you need to get through the Senate. How does that look to you? Do you think they could succeed?
Well, certainly it's three senators who represent a spectrum in the Senate on many issues, and including this one. Clearly, they're attempting to reach out to the coal industry, which would be an important factor to get support if this were to go forward. They're reaching out to the nuclear industry, which would again be an important factor. And so it's possible you could put together a piece of legislation. The problem is that the clock is working against us, that the it is highly unlikely that they will get anything done this year. And most environmental lobbyists believe they only have a window of opportunity of about 4 months next year to get something done before the Congress is unlikely to take a tough vote before the 2010 elections, especially given the results of these elections this year. So it's a very narrow window of opportunity, and we shouldn't discount the fact that it's possible that health care legislation may slip into next year. And that, of course, then would compress the legislative calendar. So it's a very narrow window of opportunity.
Ken.
If I can just add an element to that, the alternative for the administration is to use the authority of the Environmental Protection Agency and work through regulation to limit CO2 emissions in various ways. The problem with that is it's a terrible way to go. It doesn't have the sensitivity, it doesn't have the political legitimacy that you would want for a set of regulations that would so profoundly affect the American economy and American society. So I think it's important to go through the legislature if you can. But I think the administration has made very clear they'll go a regulatory route if necessary, or at least use that threat in order to prod the Congress to do more than it otherwise might have been willing to do.
The Diane Rehm Show recently had Lisa Jackson, the EPA administrator, on the show, and she talked about the administration's determination to use EPA rulemaking if necessary, but obviously not their preferred route either. Well, Rochelle, you were in Washington yesterday to discuss collaboration between the U.S. and China on what's called carbon capture and sequestration. First of all, tell us what that is.
Well, with so much CO2 coming out of the burning of coal, it seems very unlikely that we can accomplish the kind of solution that's necessary to diminish global warming without dealing with the CO2, the carbon dioxide that is created by all of the power plants in China and the United States that burn coal. So the challenge is to strip the CO2 out of the post-combustion flue gases after you burn coal to create electricity and for other industrial uses, and then compress it and pump it underground where it into saline aquifers or old oil wells, where then you would cap it and it would stay. Now, this technology is not new, but it's not been proven on a commercial scale. And we haven't done adequate testing of how you keep it underground and monitor it for long periods of time. And then, of course, there's a huge energy penalty. It costs something to do this. But this seems to many people to be one of a number of very promising areas for the U.S. and China to collaborate. And we are hopeful that when President Obama goes to Beijing in the middle of the month, that there will be some sort of large-scale, new, very active, aggressive, collaborative project that can be undertaken between our two countries to capture carbon and sequester it, or some other sort of program that would help help diminish greenhouse gases collaboratively. And then, of course, it's worth pointing out that the benefits of this are not only to increase the chances of diminishing global warming, but also I think it would provide a very important new concrete foundation under Sino-U.S. relations, which is always very wobbly and subject to ups and downs as the various vagaries of life assault it.
Well, do you think that kind of arrangement is likely to be struck between the U.S. and China, that we'll end up with some large test project on this?
Well, you know, as Ken said, in the Obama administration, there are an amazing number of smart, extremely able people. But there is a kind of a disaggregation. And whether everyone in the government is capable of coming together. And then, of course, there's Congress, which has to pass any legislation that would involve substantial amounts of money. And when China looks to the U.S., I mean, they do, I think, really want U.S. leadership. They're not opposed to it. But what does that mean to them? Well, I think it means money and it means technology. And the old framework of the Kyoto Protocols suggests that it is the obligation of developed countries, of wealthy countries, to help support the emissions controls of the developing countries. And this takes money. And right now, if there's one thing the United States does not have and that Congress is not willing to appropriate, is money for almost anything in China.
Orville Schell is director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. And we're also joined this hour by Bruce Stokes from National Journal, and Kenneth Lieberthal from the Brookings Institution. We're going to take a short break. Our phone lines are now open, 1-800-433-8850. You can give us a call or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. And we take questions by Twitter and Facebook. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about U.S.-China cooperation in trying to reduce the emissions, the greenhouse gas emissions from coal plants. And I'm joined by Kenneth Lieberthal, director of the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. During the Clinton administration, he was senior director for Asia at the National Security Council. And Bruce Stokes from the National Journal. He's also a fellow at the German Marshall Fund. And on the phone from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York, Orville Schell, director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Well, let's talk just for a moment about President Obama's trip to Asia. He leaves on Wednesday. Bruce Stokes, to what degree is climate change on his agenda?
Well, I think that on any presidential trip of this nature, and Ken can certainly speak to this, having arranged several, I'm sure, himself when he was in government, you want some deliverables from that trip. You want to demonstrate
deliverables being things you can
the president,
announce.
The White House can claim, you know, we went to Asia and we got X for the American people and for the world. And with the Copenhagen summit coming up, it is terribly important that the president, it seems to me, be able to demonstrate that in his time in China, he was able to come to some accommodation with the Chinese on some piece of the climate change issue. And certainly some announcement of cooperation on technology and development would be one way to go forward.
Ken Lieberthal, what are you looking for off this trip?
I think, first of all, regarding climate change, you have to separate climate change and clean energy. The politics of the two issues are very different, even though clean energy is a major part of what you want to do in order to address climate change. I think while the president is in Beijing, we're going to see a number of initiatives announced for U.S.-China cooperation on clean energy. They'll be in various spheres, maybe electric vehicles, something on coal, something on wind or solar. The details aren't yet available, but I'm pretty sure that we are seeking to get an impressive list of joint efforts that would be deliverables in the terms that Bruce Stokes just used. I don't think we're going to have any serious announcement about climate change agreement. Climate change involves the kinds of issues that were raised earlier in the program. Will the Chinese accept an emissions peak? Will the U.S. Be credible in making commitments at Copenhagen? I don't think those are issues that we can settle bilaterally. I don't think either side is inclined to do so during the president's trip. So we should look for agreements on clean energy projects, see how substantial they are, see what they promise. If they are substantial and they have good promise, that should increase momentum of everyone going into Copenhagen, because the two big emitters are now moving forward on a key part of the overall problem.
Well, you know, there are a lot of issues on which the U.S. and China are at odds. To what degree are our priorities the same when it comes to these issues?
I think we share a priority in getting ahead of climate change. We share, each of us, priorities in developing green technologies, both to address climate change and, frankly, because those technologies will be very valuable going forward. And we share a desire to build a constructive U.S.-China relationship going forward. And this issue, the issue of cooperation on clean energy and climate change, has become a top-tier issue in the U.S.-China relationship itself. So both sides see that handling this in a cooperative way, finding ways to work together on this, can actually strengthen U.S.-China relations. So I think in all those ways we share interests. We also have a lot of areas where our interests are not the same on this. China is a developing country. As Bruce mentioned earlier, they would like to get a lot of money from the U.S. and other developed countries for this. They want to get technology transfer without paying the full value of that technology. We'd like to see a different model guide this process. So we are not unanimous in our approach, but we have a number of parallel interests that we should be able to build on.
And we share some of the same political problems around this issue. One of the reasons the Chinese are reluctant to go forward too fast on dealing with climate change is they have their own industries that are threatened by this, that might suffer because of this. They also have a population where only 30% of the population believes that climate change is a very serious issue. Only 35% of Americans believe it's a very serious issue. We are near the bottom in the world, both of us, in terms of our populations seeing this as a very serious issue. So we have political problems we share that make going forward difficult.
Well, let's go to our listeners and let them join our conversation. We're going to take your calls at 1-800-433-8850. We'll go first to Sue. She's calling us from Cincinnati. Sue, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Good. I appreciated what he just mentioned, that there is skepticism in the American population about global warming being real. I have looked at it extensively and concluded that, in fact, carbon emissions are not the issue, that we're in the middle of a normal cycle. In fact, the same guys in the White House that are really proponents of global warming were proponents of global cooling 30 years ago. So that's one point I want to make. And the second reason you're going to see skepticism is because there's a growing awareness that the treaty that they're looking at in Copenhagen actually includes a great deal of giving up of sovereignty on the part of nations, gives a great deal of control to the UN, and frankly, people don't trust the UN. They think that's a really bad idea. So I'd like to have you comment on that, because there is a huge awareness of the sovereignty issue, not just and the idea is, why would you do something that costs too much money based on faulty science and give up your sovereignty to boot? The whole thing sounds ridiculous to most Americans.
Sue, thanks so much for your call. You know, I interviewed yesterday Mike Huckabee, the former Arkansas governor, who we think is going to be one of the contenders for the Republican presidential nomination, who said just what you said, that he doesn't believe the science is sound on global warming, and he said that 20 years ago the warnings were about global cooling. So, Ken Lieberthal, what do you think about that argument?
I think actually it is remarkable to see the extent of scientific consensus that global warming is not only occurring but is accelerating. So that the consensus, the kind of midline view in the models of where this was headed and over what period of time, as of even 3 years ago, has now moved sharply in a more accelerated direction as additional evidence comes in. This evidence is not one or two items or one or 200 items or one or 2,000 items. This is literally a vast array of sensing devices keyed into what you would expect from various kinds of models, and it is really quite extraordinary that there is a view out there that the science on this is really very uncertain or very faulty. To me, that's on a par with saying that evolution is still very much in doubt, where, frankly, if you look at the science, it's very hard to doubt it, doubt that it occurred.
Yes, go ahead.
The one other point I make is climate does not respect national boundaries, period. It is the prototypical transnational issue. Now, you need to have solutions that are very sensitive to national cultures and institutions and capabilities and politics. I absolutely affirm that. But we need a level of transnational coordination and cooperation that is quite unusual because the problem has absolutely no respect at all for national boundaries.
Bruce.
Two things. It seems to me that we are people who have prided ourselves through our history of being prudent. And it seems to me prudence dictates that we assume that the science is right because the cost of being wrong is unimaginable. If, in fact, the climate would increase, the temperature would increase by more than 2 degrees centigrade, we could see easily a permanent decline of 5% in the global GDP, maybe 20% of the global GDP. We would all be profoundly poorer, those of us who weren't living in beachfront properties in the Appalachians, because the sea had risen. So I think that we have to understand that prudence dictates that we take the cautious course, and that is to take the science seriously and try to mitigate the emissions problem that we face. The reality is, if the science is right, and as Ken said, the overwhelming number of scientists in the world believe it is right, we're going to see an increase in the temperature of about 2 degrees centigrade, whether we like it or not, no matter what we do. And the danger is what scientists call an overshoot and collapse mode, where we overshoot the sustainability of the ecosystem by the warming of the temperature, and we can't reverse it quickly. And so we have to be prudent.
Overshell, let's talk about Sue's other point, which is she's concerned about a loss of sovereignty on this issue. Could you respond to that?
Well, I think we're living in a new world where, of course, we have nation states and we need to protect national boundaries, and sovereignty is still an issue. But there's a whole host of issues which transcend these boundaries. Let me just raise one. We have a project that is studying the melting glaciers in the Himalaya and the Karakoram. Now, as it turns out, every major river system of Asia, from Afghanistan to Pakistan, India, all of Southeast Asia, China, Burma, Bangladesh, all of these rivers, the Yellow, the Yangtze, Mekong, Irrawaddy, Salween, Brahmaputra, Ganges, Indus, all rise in this arc of mountains in what is known as the Third Pole, the largest ice field short of the North or South Pole. These ice fields are melting. It is absolutely undeniable. All you have to do is go and look at it and compare photos from 75 and 100 years ago. This has a transnational implication because all of Asia, all of the great civilizations of Asia have grown up around these rivers. And if this sort of frozen water tower, as it is known up here, is diminished, it's going to have very profound impacts. You could have water wars. You could have mass migrations. This is no joke. And if you think sovereignty has to be maintained in a 19th century manner, well, what happens when people start marching over borders to fight over water? Then sovereignty and the abridgment of sovereignty gains a whole other dimension.
We have an email from Roland writing us from Fredericksburg, Virginia, who says, It is disheartening to hear of a poll earlier this year that climate change was at the very bottom of a list of Americans' 20 greatest concerns. What gives us the right to dictate what China needs to do? We need to clean up our own house first. Let's go to Dustin. He's calling us from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi, Dustin.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good. I listen to this every day. I was wondering, when coal plants started in this country and anywhere making with the electricity, they had an upfront cost and no regulation on of course the gases and stuff that they were putting into the environment. But now that we see things change, how is it a problem that if you change it and give them these regulations, say we're going to start from here and you need to use the money that you can, just like you would start up a coal business back in the old days, you knew that the money was going to be made. That's about all. I can take my answer offline.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. What's the impact on the coal industry, do you think, Bruce? And to what degree is the coal industry a player in this whole debate?
Well, any attempt to limit our use of coal would obviously affect their interests and the interests of thousands of Americans who work for the industry or whose families work for the industry. Their communities depend on that industry. It is often ignored that an attempt to clean up the coal, to make it cleaner — we can't have clean coal, but we can have cleaner coal — creates jobs. There's jobs in the new technologies that would be needed to be developed, jobs in the monitoring and the dealing with carbon sequestration and so forth, all of which is opportunities to create jobs. So there's both opportunities and costs here. But it is true that in the current lobbying effort against climate change legislation, the coal industry is playing a major role. Your viewers only need to turn on their television sets at night and see ads that are paid for by the coal industry, which either say this is too expensive or say because of the recession we need to wait. So it's clear that from their perception of their own self-interest, they would like this legislation and these efforts to go away.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Orville Schell.
Just to add a footnote to what Bruce just said, I think one can also look at a technology like carbon capture and sequestration as a burden to coal, of course, the coal industry. But one could also look at it as the salvation of coal, because it is, I think, undeniable that at some point in the near future, if we continue to burn coal in a primitive sort of 19th century manner, we will have to stop doing it. So I think if the coal industry were actually forward-thinking, they would realize that they need to save themselves with real clean coal technologies that can control carbon emissions.
Because you're in the United States and in China, we're not looking at a world without coal-fired plants, correct? They're going to be part of the energy picture?
I don't think anytime soon will we escape coal. And moreover, I think it's more than likely that sooner rather than later, the United States will pass legislation putting a price on carbon, which will then suddenly make it essential to capture these gases and do something with them.
You know, one of the ways you see this play out in the political debate is that the divide on the energy bill in the Senate isn't entirely along Republican and Democratic lines. A lot of it's along geographic lines, and to what degree coal plays in the state of a particular senator.
Well, generally speaking, if you look at the Democratic Party, they divide on this issue of carbon capture and sequestration, and the people who represent either heavy manufacturing states or big coal states, where coal is a major source of power and or it's a major resource that the state has in mines and sells, those folks vote their local interests, and it's very, very tough to get them in line with legislation that arguably is not going to be good for their own state.
So how do you get over that? If you believe in this legislation, Bruce Stokes, how do you get beyond the kind of geographic concerns of senators who, after all, are elected to some degree at least to reflect the interests of their local states?
Well, if we knew how to do that, we would have already done it. One would hope that you have at least some leaders who step above the fray and take the interests of future generations into account and future generations of their own voters into account. And it's possible that these new efforts in the Senate to come up with some kind of bipartisan solution may be a way to do that. But I must admit that I'm a bit pessimistic because it does seem to me that while it's possible we will pass some kind of legislation at some point, whether it's sufficient legislation to deal with the problem is a totally separate issue because in Washington and in diplomacy in general, there is a tendency to kick the ball down the road when you can't solve a tough problem. You think that time will help you solve it. The problem with this climate change issue, if you believe the climate science, is that time's our enemy. And the longer we wait to address the problem, the harder it's going to be and the less chance we have to actually avoid serious global warming.
We're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we'll go back to the phones and take your calls and we'll read your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org, by the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Best-selling writer Barbara Kingsolver discusses her work on social justice and the importance of stories in our culture. Her latest novel explores how history and public opinion can shape a life. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. The Copenhagen conference comes up in just about a month. Rochelle, I think there'll be some disappointment there with the failure of the United States to pass the energy bill. Now it looks unlikely that'll get done by then. So what are you looking for out of the Copenhagen conference?
Well, I mean, I think I was recently in Copenhagen at a pre-conference conference, and I think there's a great deal of sort of incredulity, particularly in Europe, that the United States is in such a disarray, that this country, which they've turned to for leadership, seems so incapable of leading. And I think actually you can interpret Obama's Nobel Prize as a kind of a down payment on future returns, just hoping that if Europe could do something like give him a prize, they'd help boost his chances of dealing with problems like this. So I think the best they're going to be able to do is come to some sort of political understanding which extends the discussion. I frankly don't think the United States is going to have its ducks in a row when we go there. And without that sort of key piece of the puzzle, other key pieces like China and India are going to remain in abeyance waiting. There's a lot of people waiting on the United States.
So, Bruce Stokes, what with this new reality, what would success look like in Copenhagen? What could we say in 6 weeks? Boy, that conference really delivered?
Well, I fear to the average person, there's nothing the diplomats can do than call success that the average person would judge to be a success. So the question is, can the diplomats do something that passes the average person's laugh test? I think there will be a political commitment to resolve this problem. The G20 countries, the biggest industrial countries, have already committed themselves to halt global warming at only 2 degrees centigrade, 2 degrees Celsius. So this would be a great people would claim this was a real new commitment, although it's not new. There'll be probably an agreement of the framework. Here are the issues we need yet to resolve. There'll be some vague commitment of more money. The Europeans have already put forward an offer. I'm sure the Japanese will as well. There will be a set of principles that people could agree to, a commitment to acknowledge that, in fact, this is a problem and, in fact, the rich have to help the poor deal with it. Much of this, of course, we've already committed ourselves in different fora, and there'll be a commitment to meet again, which is one of the difficulties we'll face, in the sense that by delaying, you send a message to the U.S. Senate that what's the rush, that could further slow the process in the U.S. Senate.
We have an emailer who says, I agree with all the arguments about climate warming, that it is real and that it's caused by activities of man, but I'm wondering if it is already too late to correct the problem. Ken, what would you say to this person?
It may well be, but we don't have any choice other than to do the best we can. Again, as I mentioned earlier, the science on this keeps getting increasingly sobering. The speed of acceleration of global warming is greater than people thought even a few years ago. There are a lot of unknowns there. What we're finding is a lot of the unknowns are actually kicking in the wrong direction. In other words, things are faster than we anticipated, not slower. So we're headed for some very, very deep trouble. And the question is whether we can rein that in. To me, it's a moral obligation to the next generation that we make maximum efforts to do that. I think nobody knows how successful we can be.
Let's go to Flint, Michigan, and talk to Bryce. Bryce, you're on the air. Thanks for holding on.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I was struck, as you were, by the first caller who basically parroted the same talking points that Mike Huckabee did the other day. And when I hear people who believe in global warming, they basically parrot the talking points of Al Gore, et cetera. And I think the big problem is that this is very deep science that people really don't understand on a real profound level. But what we do understand deeply is that fossil fuels are finite, and it seems that the pro-global warming advocates would do well to concentrate more on the idea that the world economy that solves this problem first is going to be the dominant world economy in the future. And get away from the political, because this has become political because Al Gore is involved and you have, the oil lobbies, et cetera. So make it about the economics, which people, I think, would understand more deeply.
Bryce, interesting point. Bruce, what do you think?
Well, I think the listener's onto something there. I think that if you look at China, for example, they have doubled their wind power capacity every year for the last 4 years. They are becoming a major player in renewable energy, from photovoltaics to solar hot water heaters to wind power. That kind of technological advance will translate into a competitiveness advantage in years ahead. The Germans have demonstrated, for example, with their commitment to renewable energy, that they have become a major player in that technology. We need to commit ourselves to those kinds of technologies in the same way, to the same degree, so that we can reap competitive advantage from that. We have to remind ourselves, though, economics is only a piece of this. And an economics argument, which is very compelling to our listener, very compelling to someone like me who writes about economics, often is not going to sway someone who just doesn't believe the science.
Is there a nation now that's doing what you're suggesting, investing in this area, gaining the competitive advantage that Bryce talks about?
Well, if you look at the array of things one would invest in to get competitive advantage, my short list would be wind, solar, nuclear, hydro, biofuels, electric vehicles, high mileage standards, overall energy efficiency targets and cleaner coal. You know, you look across that spectrum, and the remarkable thing about China at this point is they are making heavy investments in every single item I just listed. And they certainly see this in part as gaining competitive advantage. They figured they were losers in the Industrial Revolution. They kind of missed the Information Revolution. They had to buy our products, not sell us products there. For the new Green Revolution, they want to be first movers. They want to be the ones who are doing the selling. And frankly, you know, that they see that as part of their ticket to the future.
Orville Uchtel, I wonder, why is China so ahead on this? Because in some ways we find its government pretty hidebound. Why on this issue are they so far ahead?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. And I think that's a key question, because 2 or 3 years ago, I think all of us remember talking about climate change in China and kind of getting the deer in the headlights look. But there's been an extremely rapid acceleration of awareness and consciousness in China. And I think they have caught on very quickly to this idea that the green tech revolution is going to be the information technology revolution. And this is where there will be money to be made. And this is why this is such an extremely important moment in Sino-U.S. relations, and why the president's trip to Asia shortly could be such a symbolic opportunity. Because if the United States could fashion a partnership, we have much to offer and China has much to offer, then I think we might sally forth jointly. If we miss this opportunity, I don't think it's going to be too many years that we will have very little to offer. And China could just outstrip us, and we would find ourselves left behind. Now, let me say one thing about the science. You know, that argument for me is very suspect, because there are many things I don't understand. I don't understand how a flu shot works. When I go in for an operation, I don't understand all the science. But I do trust scientists. I trust reason. I trust logic. And I do think that we have to sort of, in certain ways, none of us on this program are scientists. We have other specialties. We've come to learn what a layman can. But we must trust our experts who have spent their lifetimes looking into these issues. And to be a skeptical layman, I think, takes a special kind of arrogance, unless you actually know what you're talking about.
We have a question submitted by Twitter, kind of a scientific question. I don't know if anyone on the panel can address it. The question is this: has there been any progress in the re-solidification of CO2 into industrial building materials, as can be done with concrete? Ken?
This is something that theoretically is possible, but to my knowledge has not been demonstrated, and certainly has not been demonstrated on a commercial scale. So it's a subject that has been discussed. You can crystallize, under the right conditions, you can crystallize CO2, eventually get a cement-like substance out of it. I think that's a very long way from being a practical solution to this.
Are there others?
And it's costly.
I'm sorry, Orville, shall go ahead.
It's costly.
Are there other new technologies that look kind of pie in the sky now, but you think might really help us out on this issue of greenhouse gas emissions? Things like re-solidifying CO2 into building materials.
If I could jump in here. Your question, I think, reflects an American fascination with technology, which we all share. All the polls show that we are the most technologically optimistic people in the world. But that requires scientific breakthroughs, which may or may not happen in a linear fashion. There's much we can do that we know how to do in a regulatory fashion to incentivize these technologies. The Germans, for example, have created a rate structure in their electricity system that allows people to put solar collectors on the roof, to sell that solar power back to the power companies at a fixed rate that ensures them a profit, They can then go to a bank with that contract and borrow money for 20 years to put the solar collector on the roof, and it makes every householder an entrepreneur. How American is that? But we can't do it. We haven't been able to do it in our country because we have a fractured regulatory system. Different states do it different ways, and nobody wants to venture forth. I think those are things we can do that don't require new technology. They just require regulatory changes.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Hank. He's calling us from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Hank.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I enjoy the program as always.
Great.
My question or comment was this. One of your commentators was talking before about the political problems faced by the Chinese and U.S. governments in getting through any meaningful changes on this topic. I think that's kind of misleading. China, for all you may say about it, is still an authoritarian system, and the center there can impose what it wants to a great extent. They don't have anything that is an equivalent obstacle to our parliamentary senatorial powers in these matters. And I wonder if that doesn't suggest that we should look for ways to take advantage now of China's ability to impose changes and try to exchange concessions with them now before too much time goes by, in which, paradoxically, China will become more democratic and more difficult to deal with.
Oh, all right, Hank, thanks very much for your call. Ken Lieberthal, you're smiling.
Well, the Chinese Revolution occurred 60 years ago. The Chinese political system has evolved a lot. It still is authoritarian, but it's authoritarian built around interests in the system. And the system is very much a fossil fuel-based system. So the really big interests in the Chinese economy are in the cement industry, the steel industry, petrochemicals, power generation, and coal. And so and most of the top players have come up through those bureaucracies, and those bureaucracies remain extremely powerful in the system. So what the top can do quite effectively, and what we've seen recently, is they can take money and throw it at a problem. But they cannot simply change regulations willy-nilly and have everyone jump to if those regulations are going to undermine their major tax base and their major constituencies within the Chinese Communist Party. So this is authoritarian but. And not strictly Mao Zedong in the old days could say, you know, do this and the whole country jumped too.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Mishawaka, Indiana, and talk to Gary. Gary, I hope I said the name of your town correctly.
I'm just calling. I'm just concerned about, I don't hear a lot of concern with keeping Americans with conservation. Nobody seems to be concerned with Americans conserving more. We use so much energy in this country, and nobody seems to really point a finger at us. We don't point a finger at ourselves. And, you know, at some point, a war is going to happen, and the world needs it to, they owe it to themselves to point a finger at us and blame us for overusing the resources of this planet. That's all I've got to say.
You know, Gary, you make a good point, but I wonder, you know, I guess I do see ways in which Americans kind of individually take energy conservation more seriously, even something like taking a reusable bag to the grocery every week, which my husband does now. You know, 2 years ago, he would have felt ridiculous doing that. Now you see a lot of people doing that. I wonder if there's been some kind of change in American attitudes.
Well, I think there has, but it's grudgingly slow and certainly not up to the task. And still, we're confronted with the daunting figure that Americans use more than four times the same or emit four times the amount of greenhouse gases and use four times more energy than the average Chinese. So there's a huge disparity still in terms of consumption. And I share the caller's concern that we certainly could cut back, I think, a significant amount without substantially altering our standard of living.
You know, there's an additional dimension to this. For many people around the world, certainly for people in China, America defines what it means to be modern, and they aspire to be modern. And frankly, our style of life is very, very energy inefficient. We are gluttons. And if we were to change our national ethos in a really palpable way, if it became a society focused on conservation and focused on low carbon and that kind of thing, we would have a tremendous impact on China because what it means to be modern now has changed.
So what would we do, just briefly, if we were going to be very focused on that?
Oh, I think it's a combination of things, but one component of it has to be that we get serious about cap-and-trade legislation. In other words, get serious about reducing our carbon emissions, but then adopt all kinds of other regulations and practices to make people really in their own lives think about the impact of their lives on the environment, and in this case, particularly on carbon emissions, and reduce that and put in smart meters and all that kind of thing to facilitate that process.
And economists would tell us we have to pay more for energy, that it's not the only solution, but the market-based system gives signals to people about what they spend their money on. And if gasoline costs $4 a gallon, not $2 a gallon or $2.80 a gallon as it does now, then, in fact, people would use less.
Bruce Stokes, Kenneth Lieberthal, and Orville Schell, I want to thank all three of you for joining us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.